Good morning, everybody. If you could all come on in and get your seats, we'll get started. First, before I introduce our speaker again, once again, I want to remind everybody about the internal medicine update course that is March 24th, 25th, and 26th. It's the afternoon, Friday afternoon, the 24th, and then Saturday and Sunday mornings. We've got a great lineup of speakers, and we'd like everybody to register. Again, it's free for all Boca Hospital staff and FAU medical students and residents. So we'd like to welcome everybody to attend. Anyways, this morning I'm going to introduce Dr. George Coriotti. Dr. Coriotti received his medical education from the State University of New York Health Science Center in Brooklyn, New York. He did an internal medicine internship at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and residency at State University of New York Health Sciences in Brooklyn. He did his interventional radiology fellowship at the University of Colorado, where he specialized in skiing. And he then moved to South Florida, and he's currently the medical director of interventional radiology and interventional oncology here. He's also one of the volunteer faculty for FAU. And today he's going to talk on an update on venous and pulmonary artery intervention.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I'm going to apologize because I actually made this talk to go an hour, and I just found out I have actually less than that. I have 10 minutes less, so I may be talking a little bit fast. If I do, I apologize, talking faster than normal. I rehearsed this talk last night in front of my wife and my dog, and they both fell asleep, so hopefully that's not foreshadowing of what's to come here in the audience today. So this is my talk, update on venous thromboembolic disease interventions. So just real quick numbers, I don't want to go into these too much, but incidence of these is actually very high, 1.6 in 1,000 people, up to 10 in 1,000 in the elderly population. By the time you're 80, your cumulative risk of getting a VTE is about 11%. And that accounts to from 600 to 900,000 cases annually and about a half million hospital admissions. So the incidence of VTE is greater than the incidence of the two most common cancers, prostate and breast cancer. Despite this, it's often undiagnosed or missed. PE can mimic or accompany pneumonia, CHF, non-ST elevation MI, asthma, and even anxiety. And 10% to 30% of VTE patients actually die within the first 30 days of diagnosis. And those that survive, they have a 30% risk of having another VTE within 10 years. So how good are we at diagnosing PE or VTE? So if you look at this EMPEROR study, and every cool study has to have an acronym, so this one is EMPEROR. If you look, they took 2,408 patients with suspected pulmonary emboli. And they had 1,880 that were confirmed to have PE, they had 528 that were not confirmed to have PE. And when you look at the presenting symptoms between those two groups, they're very, very similar. They're almost identical between the things you think about on the left, the presenting symptoms. So looking just at the symptoms alone is not helpful. But obviously, they will give you your pretest probability. We can start with something simple, a blood test, serum D-dimer. Serum D-dimer is great. It's a degradation product of fibrinolysis. It has a very, very high sensitivity for any kind of thrombus in the body. So if you have a DVT or PE, your sensitivity is as high as 95%. So it's a very high negative predictive value. If you have a negative D-dimer test, your 3 months risk of having a thromboembolic disease is less than 1%, so it's great for ruling it out. However, it has low specificity for DVT or PE, because anything that causes thrombus can cause it. A lot of conditions can produce fibrin that can cause D-dimer elevation, and so the positive predictive value is very low. Multi-detector CT is the gold standard nowadays. It has high spatial and temporal resolution. It visualizes pulmonary arteries, at least the segmental, probably second order, third order branches. The negative predictive value is very high. It should be close to 96% as long as the bolus is timed properly, and that's very important. So that's why you have like a bit of a range there. If you have a poor timing bolus, you're not gonna have a good result. The positive predictive value is also very high. And you can see on the scan, running awfully fast here. So you can see, the main pulmonary artery, you can see the right and left pulmonary arteries, and you can see these large filling defects in this patient. So you can see down to main pulmonary arteries, you can see down to second order, third order branches. You can see pretty well. When you're looking at all these dots out in the periphery, when you're looking at these really, really small vessels, it's really hard to make diagnosis on those. It's easy to get confused and call overcall or undercall PE. So you really don't want to look at these little dots out in the periphery. But certainly centrally, certainly the large main branches and even second or third order branches, you can do a pretty good job. And the nice thing about it is you can look at it in multiple projections too. It doesn't give you any additional data, but sometimes it helps you see and clarify if there is a PE when you look at different projections. Ventilation perfusion scan, you know, old study, it's been around forever. It's a great test if you can't do a CTA for whatever reason on a patient. They can't have contrast allergy, high creatinine. But is it a tough test? It's actually a tough test to interpret for radiologists. And even when the radiologists interpret it properly, it's tough for the clinicians to interpret the interpretation. So, for example, you have the old PIOPED criteria here. So you have a high probability, low probability, normal. So high probability is easy. You know what that means. The patient has likely PE. You treat them for PE. Normal is normal. What do you do with these patients here in the middle, intermediate and low probability? Do you treat those? Do they have a PE? Do they don't have a PE? It's hard to really know what to do with them. So the modified criteria, modified whatever you want to call it, is, you know, you have the high probability, you know they have a PE, treat them as a PE. You have the normal, no PE, don't treat them. And, you know, you really have this basket of just non-diagnostic, which, sorry, but we can't help you with those. You know, you really need a good negative chest x-ray to get a good ventilation perfusion scan. So it's not always that helpful. The old gold standard, I'm going to call it the old gold standard, even some people think it's still a gold standard, is pulmonary angiography. It's really great. It can visualize 1 to 2 millimeter thrombi, really peripheral, but it's not done anymore for diagnostic purposes. We do pulmonary angiography in terms of when we're doing a treatment, but we don't do it for diagnostic. Minor complication rate and major complication rates are low. There is a 0.5% death rate. You know, you're putting contrast into a pulmonary artery that has high pressure. So it's not something that's routinely done or even advocated. Echocardiography for diagnosing pulmonary emboli is not great for diagnosis. It has a negative predictive value of only 40%, but it is very useful as an adjunct tool. When you have patients with PE, it's good to know if they have RV strain. It's important to know the RV to LV ratio, which you can see if there's tricuspid regurge. You can measure the pulmonary artery pressure using the Doppler shift and plugging it in, the velocity measurements into the Bernoulli equation. And for those who are really motivated, here's the Bernoulli equation for you to sort through. So that can give you your pulmonary artery pressure, which is often very helpful. So when you talk about PE, you can stratify them into three main categories. You have the massive PE category, which is luckily a very small sliver of patients, 5% of the patients. You have the submassive category, which is about 40%. And you have the largest part of the majority of them, which is the minor low-risk PE. And you can see that it's very different between those three. You know, the massive PE has a 58% mortality risk at 3 months. It's almost 60% of the patients are going to die within 3 months. The minor PE, it really should be zero mortality. So, and then you have this big group in the middle, which is not insignificant. This is a really large group in the middle, which with mortality rates all over the place. They reported from anything from 2 to 3% up to 21%. Now you might notice that there's a BDG symbol. I did get some of these slides for information from BTG. So I want to thank them for that. And Peggy here is from BDG. She's kind of like hanging out watching that I use her slide properly. So when you risk stratify these patients, you know, the massive, the high risk patients are the ones that are in the ICU with hypotension, circulatory collapse, are the ones that are on depressors. The minor ones show up with dyspnea or chest pain and are sent home with a small PE treatment. Then these middle patients, and we do want to focus a little bit on these. Those are the ones that are not on pressors. They're not in hypovolemic shock. They're not, you know, in massive shock in the ICU. But they do have right ventricular dysfunction. They have right ventricular strain. And they may have evidence of heart injury, heart muscle injury with elevated troponin, elevated BNP. Or they may not. So these are kind of like a sort of a sub-stratification of these. They're showing evidence of heart injury. So the minor risk people in this group, well, this is very easy. You know, we all know the answer to this. You know, unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, transition it to your oral poison of choice. You treat them for 3 months if you have whatever provoking event is no longer present. So if you have a patient that showed up after a long flight, a patient that had major surgery, event is gone, you know, the inciting event is no longer there, treating them for 3 months should be plenty. If the provoking event persists, you have a patient with a cancer, or for whatever reason you still have whatever the provoking lesion is, then you really want to treat those as long as that lesion persists. So you may want to treat those patients indefinitely. For patients that you can't figure out why they had their PE, you actually want to treat those patients longer, a minimum of 6 months, probably even longer, because their recurrence rate of PE is as high as 20%. So we know that anticoagulation doesn't actually dissolve any clot, right? So you have to count on your own fibrinolytic pathways to dissolve the clots, and that can take weeks or months to do. But these patients here don't have weeks or months. These are the high-risk PE population with a really high mortality at 3 months, so they can't sit around waiting for their own body to clear their clot. So for those patients, IV thrombolytics is actually recommended. So IV thrombolytics in hemodynamically unstable patients restores the pulmonary perfusion more rapidly than anticoagulation alone. That leads to early resolution of obstruction, leads to prompt reduction in the pulmonary artery pressure, improvement in RV function, and they actually have a really high response rate of 90% or more. And it is associated with reduction in mortality in the patients with high-risk PE. The downside to this is, of course, the dreaded bleeding complication risk. The bleeding risk varies in literature anywhere from 0.8% to 22%. Intracranial hemorrhage risk is as high as 2 to 3%. And bleeding risk increases in our patient population, which is older, over 65, the bleeding risk goes up even more. But we can lower that. You know, some of this data about the 22% is from older literature. We do want to give concomitant heparin to these patients while we treat them, but we really want to monitor and keep an eye on it. We don't want those PTTs to skyrocket. If you're managing the patients yourself, managing the heparin yourself, that's ideal. If pharmacy is managing it, make sure they know the patients can getting a concomitant IV thrombolytic, because you really want to keep those PTTs low. You don't want those to overshoot, because that can increase your risk of bleeding. And of course, if you have untreated really bad hypertension, you're going to increase risk of intracranial bleed. So you want to manage the blood pressure, you want to manage the PTT. So when you look at trials, you know, do we have any data to support this? Well, if you look at a meta-analysis of the randomized clinical trials comparing the thrombolytics to heparin, not heparin, sorry about that, you find 11 trials and 748 patients. That includes all the PE and massive PE. If you subselect out the major PE trials, there are about 5 trials of those, you find that there's a significant improvement in the patients that are treated with lytics. So about half of those have recurrent PE or death. So less than half have recurrent PE, and about half of the ones that get thrombolytics die compared to the ones that don't. The downside to that, of course, is the bleeding risk, which is doubled with the patients who are getting the thrombolytics. So the analysis of this is compared with heparin, thrombolytic therapy was associated with a significant reduction in pulmonary embolism or death in the 5 trials that included patients with major hemodynamically unstable pulmonary embolus. So there's no evidence for benefit in the thrombolytic therapy if you take all comers. If you take all comers with PE, you give them all thrombolytics or heparin, you don't benefit. But if you subselect out the high-risk group, there is significant benefit. So a clear benefit is suggested among those at the highest risk of recurrence or death, in particular patients with major pulmonary embolus with hemodynamic instability. So that's the massive PE patients. You know, they have the hypotension, hemodynamic instability, circulatory collapse. They get IV thrombolytics. IV tPA is administered at 100 milligrams accelerated dose over 2 hours. You know, there's prolonged infusions which you can do, and there's a rapid infusion, so over 2 hours. And again, keep an eye on the blood pressure, keep an eye on your PTT. So we dealt with the minor PE, we dealt with the massive PE. What about this whole big subgroup in the middle? What do we do with those? Well, this graph actually is from the 2014 European Society of Cardiology guidelines, and it kind of shows like a little pattern of what contributes to hemodynamic collapse in acute PE. So you start with your PE, it's going to give you increased RV afterload. You get right ventricular dilatation. You start getting tricuspid valve insufficiency, increased wall tension. You start getting neurohormonal activation and myocardial inflammation, which raises the oxygen demand on the right ventricle, giving you the right ventricular ischemia, decreasing right ventricular contractility, decreasing right ventricular output, which is, of course, going to decrease your left ventricular preload. That, and along with the fact that the pulmonary artery is blocked up, you're going to have low cardiac output, blood pressure is going to drop, you get decreased coronary perfusion, you get decreased oxygen delivery, and it spirals down to cardiogenic shock and death. So that's what you want to kind of try to avoid if you can. So the rationale for more aggressive therapy is to reduce the thrombus burden, to improve the pulmonary reperfusion, capillary blood flow, and gas exchange, to decrease the RV afterload and prevent RV failure and hemodynamic collapse. And on top of that, you want to decrease the risk of developing chronic pulmonary hypertension. So when we look at some papers that looked at this RV to LV ratio, specifically in RV dysfunction, so there's a couple of papers that showed that if you have an RV to LV ratio of less than or equal to 0.9, your in-hospital mortality is less than 2%, and adverse events rate is about 50%. If you look at an RV to LV ratio of greater than 0.9, your in-hospital mortality actually shoots up to 6.6%. So here's another study that showed that if your RV to LV ratio is less than 1, your 3-month mortality is 0. If it's greater than 1.5, your 3-month mortality is as high as 17%. An RV to LV ratio between 1 and 1.5, your mortality is 8. So there's a pretty good correlation there. So another named trial, the iCOPR registry, actually looked at 2,454 consecutive PE patients, 52 hospitals, 7 countries, and they looked at the presence of RV hypokinesis relation to mortality. And they found that when you have RV hypokinesis, that's a 57% increased mortality rate at 3 months. So here you see it in graph form, mortality rate, no hypokinesis, hypokinesis, significant increase in mortality of these patients. So we know RV to LV ratio is important. We know right ventricular function is important. How do we measure it? Well, we get a 4-chamber heart view, find an end-diastolic image, draw a center line through the intraventricular septum, obtain a line through the tricuspid annulus, go a centimeter down from that, and then measure endocardium to endocardium. So line through the septum, line through the tricuspid annulus, 1 centimeter down, endocardium to endocardium. And that's the ratio you're looking for. And you can do this on echo, you can do this on CT. You know, echo is nice because you can stop the frame and find your best diastolic image, and you do your measurements. CT, and here you see this right ventricle is markedly enlarged compared to this left ventricle. You can actually see bowing of the intraventricular septum towards the left ventricle. So this is a right ventricular strain pattern. I'm not an echo reader, but I can get that from this, I think so. So the right ventricle shouldn't be larger than the left ventricle. You see that same thing here. You get bowing of the intraventricular septum. If you draw your line 1 centimeter down, you see that this right ventricle is significantly larger than this left ventricle, and that shouldn't be the case. This is backwards. So when you look at the PTHOS trial, pulmonary embolus thrombolysis trial, it's a multicenter randomized double-blind trial where they took a bolus of tenecteplase, one of the lytics, plus heparin versus placebo and heparin. And they did that in 1,006 patients with RV dysfunction, by echo or CT, and myocardial injury, shown by troponin. And the primary endpoint to look for was the composite all-cause death and hemodynamic collapse and decompensation. So the good things out of that is that all-cause death or hemodynamic decompensation and collapse was significantly reduced in the thrombolytic group. That's 2.6 versus 5.6%. So there's a significant decrease in the hemodynamic collapse between those two groups. The major bleeding rate was also significantly increased, and the hemorrhagic stroke rate was actually tenfold between the treatment group and the non-treated group. So that's a significant increase in intracranial hemorrhage. Again, over the age of 65, your risk of bleeding is going to increase. So what can we do to decrease those risks? Can we have the benefit of the lytosis but not have this increased risk of bleeding? That would be ideal, right? So that's what this MOPIT trial tried to figure out. So they took 121 patients with moderate PE. They didn't take those high risk 5% that are dying in the unit. They took the moderate PE patients. They made sure the systolic blood pressure is in this range, between 95 and 200. And they gave them half a dose of TPA. So instead of the 100 milligram dose, they gave a half a dose. And the primary endpoint was reduction in pulmonary artery pressure. So again, if they have the full dose, they're excluded. If they had chronic PE, which would take considered actually over 10 days, they were excluded. And of course, if you have a contraindication to lytics or heparin, they were excluded. So on admission, the numbers were pretty much the same. So here's the pulmonary artery systolic pressure, pretty much the same when they got admitted. The value is, you know, not significant. Within 48 hours, however, there was a significant drop in the systolic pressure and the pulmonary artery systolic pressure between the treatment group and the control group. And this benefit persisted even out to 28 months. So this just wasn't something that you saw in the hospital and then patients go home and that's the end of it. And actually the benefit was a lasting benefit. So the secondary endpoints in terms of looking for recurrent PE, maybe there was a little bit of less recurrent PE, which is interesting with the treatment group versus the control group. Total mortality really wasn't any different. So we're not like saving lives really in the acute setting. Hospital stay was significantly reduced and the bleeding was down to zero. So can we improve this even more? Can we make this even better? So the rationale for catheter-directed therapy comes from this flow model. And this actually came out of benchtop flow models that they did, where they showed that if you have a large saddle embolus, if you have a big central embolus, or if you have a clot on one side blocking up large branches, you actually get flow changes, and you get these turbulent flows that actually shunt blood away from the occluded areas. Which actually is pretty good when you think about it, because if you have a PE, you really want to shunt blood to the part of the lung that's working, that's functioning. So it actually works to your benefit, but when you're trying to deliver medication, it actually shunts your medication away from those clots. So it makes it harder to treat. So the rationale is, if you can break through these and deliver locally across these clots, then you can use a higher local drug concentration, you get more rapid thrombolysis, you get more even distribution of the lytics, and you can use an even lower dose of TPA and get a better effect. So we've been doing this for a long time now, you know, from the early 90s, I think. This is the beginning. What we were doing is we would just take a pigtail catheter, put it in the pulmonary artery, and actually make a hole in the end of the catheter where the wire can poke through. And basically spin this catheter around the wire to just break up those central clots that allow the TPA to go through there. And we would actually do this in the massive and submassive PE patients to try to get them to dissolve faster. And we also had infusion catheters, like a McNamara catheter, where you can actually drip the TPA in, so you put it across the thrombus so it's not all shunting the other way. Or you can even pulse spray it in, where you take these little tiny syringes and you just shoot them really hard and it pulses out to get the TPA to perfuse into the clot. And we had the AngioJet. We still have the AngioJet, but not so much for the pulmonary arteries. The AngioJet is a very cool device. It shoots high velocity stream of saline back on itself. And of course, we know from the Bernoulli equation again that if you have rapidly flowing fluid, it creates a decrease in pressure. So it created a vacuum that sucked in clots and sucked in blood with it. The nice thing about it is you're able to treat clots fairly quickly. It did tend to make channels through the clots because this device really wasn't that big. But the worst part about it is when you put it in the pulmonary artery, you would get immediate and reproducible bradycardia and asystole and heart block. So when you had this thing in the pulmonary artery, you hit the paddle, started to work, you start sucking the clot out, and you see an immediate and reproducible, almost like one-to-one drop in the heart rate. They will sometimes go into asystole. You kind of let go of the pressure and you hope they come back. A lot of times they bounce back, sometimes they didn't, but it was kind of a scary thing to be sitting there and watching. So it was so much so that the FDA put a black box warning against using this in the pulmonary arteries. There's been some different ideas of why that's so. Some say, well, it's because you're breaking up those blood clots and releasing all that potassium. I don't think that's been shown to be true. Some people say it's because it's sucking the walls of the pulmonary artery in with it that it's creating some sort of effect, but it's not really been shown what's really causing it. So we do have this device. This is, again, I got this from BTG, this slide. This is the ECOS. This is what we're using most recently. It's an infusion catheter, just like the McNamara catheter, except it has this wire that has these ultrasonic transducers along its course. And there's a couple of channels. There's channels for the lytic drug, and there's channels for a coolant to go around. So we put the catheter in the pulmonary arteries. We put these transducers in. We connect it to the machine, the generator, and we allow it to work. And what it does is it creates these ultrasound waves that go through the clot, and when you look at what it does, it separates out those fibrant strands, allowing the TPA to bind better, to perfuse better into the fibrin, into the clot. But does it work? How do we even know if it works? So let's look at the evidence for this, for catheter-directed thrombolysis. Let's look at the evidence for whether this ultrasound-directed, ultrasound-assisted thrombolysis works. And we can look at single-center studies. We can look at the meta-analysis of historical studies. And there's a couple of more recent trials that specifically involve this device. The first one was the ULTIMA trial, and that was done to determine whether fixed-dose, low-dose, catheter-directed, ultrasound-accelerated, I don't know what it's called, thrombolysis is superior to heparin alone in reversing RV dilation in this submassive intermediate risk PE category. So they took 59 patients with acute PE. They were hemodynamically stable patients in the intermediate category, but they had an RV to LV ratio of greater than or equal to 1, so greater than 0.9. And they were randomized, half into the heparin plus the ultrasound-assisted therapy, the catheter-assisted therapy, versus heparin alone. And what they showed was there was a significant decrease in the RV to LV ratio at 24 hours when you use the ultrasound-assisted catheter-directed therapy. You can see this is the pre-treatment RV to LV ratio. This is the post-treatment RV to LV ratio. And compared that to heparin alone, which really didn't change very much. You have an insignificant p-value. So when you look at the reduction in the RV to LV ratio at 24 hours and even at 90 days, you see that baseline for 24 hours, there's a significant reduction in the RV to LV ratio when using the catheter-directed thrombolysis versus when you didn't. And even at 90 days, that effect persists. So the RV dysfunction is significantly improved with the ultrasound-assisted thrombolysis versus heparin alone. What about the risks? What about the complications? Well, if you look at the complication rates, they really were very similar. There's no difference between these two groups. There was no deaths in the treated patients. One death actually in the heparin group, but that was a patient with pancreatic cancer who died of the cancer, so that doesn't really count. The recurrent VTE rates were the same. Major bleedings were zero. Minor bleeding were very low. There was really no major bleeding. So the conclusion of this trial was a fixed-dose ultrasound-assisted catheter-directed therapy was superior to the anticoagulation alone in improving the RV dysfunction at 24 hours without an increased risk of bleeding. So we don't want to increase risk of bleeding. If you look at another trial, the Seattle 2 trial, which is a prospective single-arm multicenter trial of using catheter-directed therapy versus thrombolysis, you have patients here with massive as well as submassive PE. So they actually took all comers. Primary efficacy was a change to RV to LV ratio from baseline to 48 hours. Secondary efficacy was change in invasively measured PA pressure during the procedure versus 48 hours on echo. And the primary safety was, of course, bleeding. 150 patients enrolled. Most of them were still submassive PE. Most of them were bilateral. Really, if it's not bilateral, unless you have one lung, you really probably don't want to be doing this because you really need a large clot burden to be in that intermediate category. If you have minor clot, you don't really want to be treating these patients. And the tPA dose was down to 24 milligrams instead of the 50 or 100. So the decrease in RV to LV ratio in all comers was significant at 48 hours. The pulmonary obstruction was relieved pretty quickly at 48 hours. And the pulmonary hypertension was reduced significantly at 48 hours. So there's some pretty good benefits. 30-day mortality was low. There was some bleeding. Major bleeding was 17, so 11%, but most of those were considered moderate by the Gusto criteria, which is cardiac criteria that's used. Severe bleeding was really only one patient. And intracranial hemorrhage rates were zero, so they were able to bring the intracranial hemorrhage rates down to zero. So compare that with the IV lytics compared to the catheter-directed. 2% is not high, but when you have a risk of intracranial bleed of 2% to 3%, it makes you kind of consider whether you want to do the treatment. Bleeding rate of intracranial hemorrhage rate of zero is pretty good. So the conclusion is that the ultrasound-facilitated, catheter-directed, low-dose fibrinolytic improves the RV function, decreases pulmonary hypertension, and minimizes the risk of intracranial bleed. So how do we do it? Well, this is a case from here, a recent case. So what we do is, I'm not sure how you can see this in the back. I know there's a bunch of EKG leads that makes it a little difficult. But we put these catheters in. So here's this one catheter. They almost look like dog ears. So one catheter on the right, one catheter on the left. We put them in the pulmonary arteries, and they have these little dots on them. Those are the ultrasound transducers. And we put in the medication. If you're doing it unilateral, it's 24 milligrams over 24 hours. If you're doing bilateral, it's 24 milligrams over 24 hours. Either way, it's the same, except when you're doing it bilateral, you're splitting the dose half into the right, half into the left. You run the coolant through the second channel, and you got to watch your heparin and your blood pressure because you don't want to have increased risk of bleeding. Once your TPA dose is done, you run saline until it's time to get the catheters out. And so here's a pre and post. You have a pre. You know, you don't really need to measure anything here. You can just look at it. You see this right ventricle is very big. This left ventricle is squashed. Septum is pushed over. Look at the post. Now this right ventricle looks the way right ventricle is supposed to look. This left ventricle looks like the way it's supposed to look. Measurements do differ. Here's the pre-treatment RV to LV ratio 1.4, post-treatement 0.9. You can see the clots here in the pulmonary arteries. You can see that's pre-resolved here on the post. What about pulmonary embolectomy? I think at least one person here would know what that is. That's Dr. Wax and Dr. Witteroff back there. I think you might have known this this gentleman. So this is Trendelenburg's a great idea. You may not know that Dr. Trendelenburg actually invented this procedure. You know him from putting your patients upside down. You don't know that he invented the pulmonary embolectomy. And the reason you probably don't know that is because all his patients actually died. So he had 20 patients that he did, all 20 died from his procedure. So it wasn't until his pupil, his student, Martin Kirchner in 1924, who did the first successful pulmonary embolectomy. So even in the literature, even more modern day, the mortality rates are high, between 30% and 60%. But in recent articles and experienced hands, that has been brought down to 6% mortality. But that's pretty high. So that's really rarely performed. It's not something that you want to jump to. But in patients who are hemodynamically unstable, that you can't give lytics, that you can't, or that have failed lytics, you give lytics and they failed, you really might want to consider it if your cardiac surgeons or your chest surgeons willing to follow along. So what do we do with these patients? So here's a little algorithm. You have acute pulmonary embolus, you have minor low-risk patient with dyspnea and chest pain, unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, send them home on oral anticoagulation. You have the submassive group. Those are the ones you want to consider for catheter-directed therapy. You still want to anticoagulate them. Just keep an eye on your PTT. But you want to consider the thrombolytics catheter-directed to decrease your risk of bleeding. The massive PE patients, you want to treat them right away. You want to give them the bolus of TPA over 2 hours. You don't want to wait 12 hours or 24 hours for it to clear. And you still want to maintain, you know, keep an eye on your blood pressure, keep an eye on your PTT. For those that fail lytics and they're still unstable in your unit and they're afraid they're going to die on you, those are the ones you want to consider for embolectomy. Again, if your cardiologist or chest surgeon or Dr. Witteroff is willing to take them to the OR. All right, so do we have time? Good. So if we still have time, I want to talk a little bit about lower extremities. So how well do we diagnose DVT? Well, we're all very aware of it, DVT. Certainly we know the symptoms of it, the swelling, the pain, the tenderness, the deep palpation, the Hohmann sign. But if you look at all these, our accuracy of these is only about 50%, which isn't as good as you might want to think. So although the assessment of your preclinical probability improves your positive predictive value of these tests, physical exam is still not good enough. Serum D-dimer suffers from the same problems. It's great sensitivity, so if you have a negative D-dimer, you're in pretty good shape in terms of not having DVT, but specificity is low. Ultrasound, mainstay of DVT imaging, is done everywhere and every office and by everybody. It's low risk, low cost, it has high specificity, and it has a high sensitivity of 95%. With the caveat that that's from the common femoral vein to the popliteal vein. So, you know, you're seeing that this is done so much, you think, oh, it's negative, no DVT, positive DVT, but you really got to remember that it's only from the common femoral to the popliteal vein that your sensitivity is really that high, which is why on the bottom of all these radiology reports, you wonder why these radiologists put a little footnote that no one ever reads that says, you know, in the calf veins, ultrasound is really not that sensitive, and pay attention to that. Although it may not even be that important. But, so what is the sensitivity in the calf veins? It's about 80%. There are 6 calf veins, you know, 2 to go along with every artery. It depends on how good your tech is in finding all of those. It depends on how good your exam is. And they're not often easy to see, all those 6 little veins. Does it matter? It may not matter, because those aren't the ones that are causing you a pulmonary embolus. Those little calf veins are not causing you PE. Sometimes they're not even treated. Some physicians advocate not even treating them. Some patients will put them on heparin for a short period of time. But what's more important is that they don't really image the iliac veins. They don't look at the pelvic veins. They don't look at the IVC. We can infer what's going on in the iliac veins. We have patients, we measure these waveforms and look for breathing, respiratory variability. We have them Valsalva. We look for changes, but it doesn't look at them directly. Venogram is still the gold standard because it's the best at showing everything. It shows your calf veins, it shows your common femoral SFV and your popliteal, and it shows your iliacs and the IVC, but it's rarely used nowadays. You can tell by the age of this slide I put in, which is ancient. It does have a little bit of risk, a little bit of patient discomfort, has higher cost, but most important, it's just not readily available. It's been used so rarely that most radiologists don't even remember how to do this, or think that it's beyond their scope to even do a venogram nowadays, because it's just so rarely used. But it's still the gold standard, still the best test. MRV, excellent sensitivity and specificity, as you see here, but it's not a first-line test. It's just too expensive to do MRV on everybody, and it takes a long time. When you do an MRV, as you'll see with a CTV, they're great tests, though, because not only do they show you the problem in iliac and IVC, but they also show you what's causing it. Like we said before, you know, if you have a DVT, you treat them on 3 months, but you don't treat the underlying cause, then you're not really helping the patient. The patient is going to come back with another DVT. So treating the underlying cause is vitally important in making sure your patients are well treated. So you see this patient with what's called the May-Turner syndrome. So what that is, so you have the IVC here. On the left of it is the abdominal aorta. You have the right common iliac artery, which is going in that direction, and that crosses against the left common iliac vein. And that causes an impingement here between the artery and the spine. And this causes what's called the May-Turner syndrome. And this is often undiagnosed, and this is as common as 5%, but it actually has been reported to be as common as 20% in women, which is much more common in women than men. So you get these women, especially younger women, you get the DVT, you put them on anticoagulation, say, okay, well, I don't know the cause, let's put them on 6 months or more, and you stop it, and then they come back with another repeat DVT. Well, that's because you didn't treat the underlying problem. You have to treat this. You have to fix it. Here's what it looks like on axial. Here's the right common iliac artery, left common iliac artery. Here's the crossing left common iliac vein, and here it is squashed between the artery and the spine. CT venography, a very good test. It's great because you often diagnose unsuspected DVT in the iliac and IVC because we do so many CTs nowadays. And it really is good at looking at the IVC and the iliacs. However, it does have some drawbacks. If your bolus of contrast is not tailored to your veins, you can easily underdiagnose or overdiagnose it. You have these flow phenomena where you have normal blood, which doesn't have contrast in it, mixing with the contrasted blood. And you can mimic a DVT. So you really have to be careful when you're trying to diagnose DVT on CTE that your contrast bolus is really correct, just like you have to actually in a pulmonary arteriogram. So we diagnosed the VTE, or venous thromboembolus, in the lower extremities. Well, now what do we do with these patients? Well, VTE is actually a spectrum, going from superficial thrombophlebitis to phlegmasius ceruleodolens on the other extreme. So a superficial thrombophlebitis, as its name implies, is superficial, so it's not a deep venous thrombosis. And that involves greater saphenous, lesser saphenous, or other superficial veins. We don't treat it like a DVT. Symptoms are palpable. You may have a palpable cord, you may have erythema along the vein, you may have a limited swelling. Treatments are analgesics, support stockings, elevation, warm compresses. Analgesics are generally not indicated. We do get this question actually a lot. We have patients that we do an ultrasound DVT study and report greater saphenous vein thrombus. They get the call, well, do I anticoagulate these patients or not? And our answer is, well, that's for you to decide, not us. We just give you the answer of what's there, and you have to decide what to do. Generally, those patients are not anticoagulated. There are some people that do advocate anticoagulating them if there's a large clot burden and a greater saphenous, because it is a big vein. But that's not really been shown to be indicated in the studies. So what is a DVT? It actually involves common femoral vein, superficial femoral vein, where despite its name, which is a misnomer, is actually a deep vein. And we get this question actually a lot too, superficial femoral vein, do I have to treat it? Yes, this is a deep vein. This is not a superficial vein. Popliteal vein, tibial veins, anterior tibial, posterior tibial, perineal, although if it's isolated to tibial veins, you may want to under-treat, for lack of a better word. But iliac veins and IVC is actually very important. Symptoms, edema, pain, distended superficial veins, because now the blood is shunting away from the deep system to the superficial system, and the extremity is warm. Standard treatment, anticoagulation. Simple. Well, what about systemic lytics? What about catheter-directed therapy? Well, systemic lytics are out. The clot burden in a leg DVT is way too massive. You would have to give massive doses of lytics to get it all out, and your bleeding risk is will be astronomical. So systemic lytics for DVT is out. But what about catheter-directed therapy? Well, if you have this kind of patient, which is with what they call phlegmasia alba dolens, very massively swollen leg, kind of shiny, white, pale, cool, with weak or absent pulses, and absent pulses should be transient, not permanent. This is a patient you really want to consider treating with catheter-directed therapy. You don't want them to, of course, you can anticoagulate these patients too, keep an eye on the PTT, we said that a million times, but you really want to consider catheter-directed therapy. You don't want them to progress into this patient, which is a phlegmasia cerulea dolens, which is now a cyanotic, cool, painful, pulseless extremity. And you get compartment syndrome in these patients, which is basically obstructing your arterial flow. And when you get to this point, your risk of gangrene, amputation, and limb loss is pretty high. So for these patients, you want to consider an immediate surgical thrombectomy. You don't even want to wait for the catheter directed, and you may want to do a fasciotomy. So you got to call your surgeons right away because you have to improve that arterial flow. So what about your run-of-the-mill middle ground DVT? Well, the answer is not so clear. Otherwise, you'd be seeing it well there. So catheter-directed therapy goes by a lot of different things. You have catheter-directed, you have pharmacomechanical, you have thrombectomy, you have thrombolysis. There's a million different, not a million, but there's a lot of different techniques and devices. There's certainly a lot of different lytics. So it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to everybody. So we like to turn to guidelines. Why not, right? We're physicians. We feel good about ourselves when we use guidelines. We like to think that somebody smarter than us or more motivated than us poured through the literature, found the best thing for us to do, and wrote these guidelines for us to use. So why not follow them? Well, if we have to decide whose guidelines are we going to follow. If you look at the American College of Chest Physicians from 2008, they said that in selected patients with extensive acute proximal DVT, symptoms less than 14 days, good functional status, life expectancy greater than 1 year, low risk of bleeding, we suggest that catheter-directed thrombolysis may be used to reduce acute symptoms and post-thrombotic morbidity if appropriate expertise and resources are available. Well, that's in 2008. In 2012 and 2016, they changed their mind. They said that in patients with acute proximal DVT of the leg, we suggest anticoagulation therapy alone over catheter-directed therapy. Well, with the caveat, remarks made that the patients who are most likely to benefit from catheter-directed therapy who are high value, who have place a high value on prevention of post-thrombotic syndrome and a lower value on the initial complexity, cost, and risk of bleeding with catheter-directed therapy are likely to choose catheter-directed therapy versus anticoagulation alone. So this sort of caused in 2012 a little bit of an uproar because when they decided these guidelines, they failed to include anybody in the committees that actually did these procedures. So when you look at people that did these procedures, American Heart Association, Society of Interventional Radiology, American College of Radiology, European Society of Cardiology, Society of Vascular Surgery, well, their guidelines are quite different. You know, you see in almost all of these guidelines, some sort of statement that says catheter-directed therapy is reasonable as first-line treatment in patients with acute iliofemoral DVT to prevent post-thrombotic syndrome in selected patients at low risk of bleeding. Well, why not just anticoagulate? Well, anticoagulation is great. It prevents formation of new clots. It prevents propagation of existing clots. It reduces the risk of PE. Some degree of patency is restored in about 80% of patients at 6 weeks. Complete resolution is in about half of the patients. But again, we know that it doesn't dissolve clot. It relies on the body's own fibrinolytic mechanism, which can take weeks to months. It reduces but does not eliminate the risk of PE. You still have a 5% risk of PE. There's about a 6 to 10% failure of therapy with clot propagation. DVT recurrence is as high as 10%. Half of the patients have been found to be subtherapeutic. Those are the Coumadin patients. Risk of bleeding is still there. We all see patients that come in, whether on Coumadin or any of the new things that have bleeding, that we see that all the time. So the risk of bleeding is not insignificant. But really what we're trying to avoid is this dreaded post-thrombotic syndrome. That's what you think you're going to avoid with catheter-directed therapy. Well, what is that? Well, post-thrombotic syndrome is actually found that as high as 50%, 20 to 50%, depending on who you believe, in patients with proximal DVT. And the key here is proximal DVT. So what it is symptoms of chronic pain, swelling, discoloration, ulceration. And the patients that have this report a lower quality of life at 2 years than patients with arthritis, chronic lung disease, or even diabetes. So this is not something that you really want to not think about, at least. So is there any data to support anything that we're doing here? Well, there's this CAVIN study. Again, you need an acronym, right? Took 209 patients with acute iliofemoral DVT. And again, we're talking about proximal DVT involving the iliacs, IVC, maybe common femoral veins, which is a common point where all the blood drains from the leg. We're not talking about things that from below the inguinal ligament. We're not talking about things in SFV. We're not talking about popliteal. We're not talking about tibial. We're talking about high up clots. They divided them half into anticoagulation, half into anticoagulation plus catheter-directed therapy. They found higher patency at 6 months, and they found a significant decrease in the post-thrombotic syndrome. 37 patients, half the patients in the catheter-directed group, and a large percent of them in the control group. So the absolute risk reduction for post-thrombotic syndrome is 28%. There were 3 major bleeds, though, in the catheter-directed therapy group. So what do we do about this? You know, can we improve both of these things? Well, that's what these pharmacomechanical thrombolysis devices come into play. Again, we've had a bunch of them over the years. We had this trellis device, which was really neat. It had 2 little balloons you inflate. It had this little sinusoidal wire we just put in there. We spin it around, try to break up and fragment the clot as we're lysing it. Of course, we have the AngioJet. And again, we have the ECOS device, which is the same that we use in the pulmonary arteries. And the idea here is accelerated thrombolysis. So let's do even better than the catheter-directed therapy. Let's make it even better. Decreased infusion time, decreased lytic dose, decreased risk of bleeding. Well, this ECOS, this ultrasound device, they did a multi-center registry, 8 sites, 53 cases, acute, subacute, chronic, and acute on chronic DVT. So they even took ones that are harder to treat, the chronic DVTs, and compared it to the standard catheter-directed therapy. Well, in every case, whatever lytic you use, the median drug dose was lower, the median infusion time was lower. That's really your goal, is to decrease your bleeding. Bleeding was very similar to Coumadin and significantly lower than you see in other thrombolysis trials. So here's another study published in 2014, prospective study, 87 consecutive iliofemoral DVT patients, 20 milligrams of tPA, and they followed them 3, 6, and 12 months. They did have 1 major bleed, 6 minor bleeds, but most importantly, 94% have no signs of post-thrombotic syndrome. Baylor took even chronic DVTs. So they took acute DVTs and took chronic. But when you look at the chronic DVTs, those are notoriously difficult. When I get calls about chronic DVT, I'm like shaking my head saying, yeah, we're probably not gonna be able to help very much. But even in those, they got 64% that had 100% angiographic clearance, which is, to me, pretty impressive because I usually like to avoid those patients. So ultrasound-assisted catheter-directed thrombolysis has been shown to be safe and effective in treating these patients with DVT. When you use the devices that help you, including the ultrasound, it reduces the infusion time, provides more complete lysis, and decreased bleeding rate. Just a quick case. This is a case that was somewhat recent from last year that we did here. Iliac DVT patient, 71-year-old woman, underwent 6 back surgeries, had multiple DVTs in the course of the years, was on Coumadin, had an IVC filter placed in 2008, presented with right lower extremity swelling and a complaint of pain of 10 out of 10. So she couldn't even walk. She couldn't weight bear. Here's the CT. The CT shows, oh, that went kind of fast. I'm not expecting to see that quickly. So here's the IVC filter right here. The anterior vena cava. And if we follow that down, you see that this is completely thrombosed, inferior vena cava, actually swollen, thrombosed, all full of clot extending into the iliac vein. So we pick this patient, put him prone on the angiography table, access from the popliteal vein going up, do a venogram. Wow, that looks pretty good. There's really no DVT there. I mean, it's as clean as you'll ever want to see a venogram. Well, let's keep looking. We'll look a little bit higher up, and this is what we find. So We have a complete occlusion. We have a mess of tangled collaterals, and there's no flow at all going into the iliac or the inferior vena cava. So we put this device across. Here's the catheter. Here are the transducers. You can see them lined up on it. And we lyse it for overnight in a couple of days. And this is what we get the next day. Well, you know, we have flow, but certainly doesn't look pretty, right? But at least, well, we're getting a little bit of flow going up there. So now, of course, we need to get this improved, because that's not going to last if you have that. So I stented this here. You see the stent along. Ballooned the common femoral, because I really don't want to put a stent along the common femoral. We don't like to put stents over joints, because they do have a higher fracture rate. Plus, we don't like to put joints, so people like to stick things like catheters. So we like to avoid putting stents in areas of elbows and arms and hips. But after the angioplasty, it was like this. So, you know, this was multiple angioplasties, slow, prolonged inflations, did everything to try to get that to really work, but it didn't. So at this point, I was forced to stent it. And I can get it to go. And this is now how it looks stented. So this went from completely occluded, and you can see. All right, so one of the key things that you see is what you don't see. You don't see collaterals. You don't see this big tangle of collaterals, because flow is now going straight up this channel. So sometimes what you don't see is as important as what you do see. So this patient, at follow-up, 1 month and 6 months, there was swelling was down, no recurrent DVT, and states she feels great. So criteria, proximal DVT, iliofemoral DVT, those are the ones that have been shown. If you're talking about below the inguinal ligament, you don't want to do anything other than anticoagulate. No absolute lytics, contraindication to lytics, reasonable life expectancy. If you have an acute DVT, less than 14 days, or at least less than 21 days, you're much better off. Contraindications are the contraindications to lytics. So in terms of algorithm, superficial thrombophlebitis, analgesic support stockings, elevation, SFV, popliteal and calf veins, anticoagulation. You do want to treat an underlying lesion or cause if you have one. Proximal iliofemoral or phlegmasia cerulei alba, anticoagulation, catheter-directed therapy. Again, treat underlying lesions. If you have phlegmasia cerulei dolens, surgical embolectomy, call your surgeons to do a fasciotomy. Sorry, I talked fast, but we're done. All right, you got 6 minutes for questions. Yes. Yes. So we worry about clot burden. So with the pulmonary embolus, the bigger the clot, obviously the worse, as we've seen. Clot burdens from PICC lines, it's very rare that you have any kind of a significant PE. So it's very rare that we put, for example, a superior vena cava stent. It does happen in some patients if they already have a massive PE and whatever reason, and they have additional clots that you're worried about. SVC filters are more dangerous, more problematic. In terms of treating them, I think the real treatment is just to take the offending thing out. If you have a clot in the upper arm, take the PICC line out. What I would recommend, if you have a clot in a PICC line vein that's superficial, if you know the patient is going to need a line anyway, why take it out and put it in another vein so you get a clot in the other vein? Unless they have swelling in the arm or some symptoms that need to be treated, I would just try to leave it in. If they have swelling and they're becoming symptomatic, then you have to just take the line out. But I don't think that treatment is, in terms of anticoagulation or certainly not lytics, is indicated in those patients. Does that answer you? Now, if you do have a subclavian occlusion or thoracic outlet syndrome, which is a whole other story, then you may want to treat those subclavian lesions or efferent vein thrombosis, but that's a whole different talk. You know what? I didn't even notice that, but I don't think there was an association. I think it was the association was that she just had, you can see how much hardware is there. I don't think the hardware itself, I think it's just an overlap, superimposed image. But yeah, that's a lot of back surgery for one person. And here's the, you know, it has an IVC filter, a whole bunch of back problems. I don't think the hardware is really poking into that. I think that's just, well, but if you think about it, this actually is a transpedicle screw. That should be stopping at the vertebral body. I mean, yes, we've seen transpedicle screws go all over the place, and they certainly could put one in the wrong place. I don't think that's the case here. I think this is just an overlap, two-dimensional image. So I actually, believe it or not, had a third section here on IVC filters. But of course, when I did a run-through, I'm like, okay, I'm lucky if I get through these two parts, so I didn't put filters in here. IVC filters, it's great, and it's indicated for people who have failed anticoagulation, people who have propagated clots on anticoagulation, people who have who have had anticoagulation and come in with bleeds, you have to take them off of it. But it's really not indicated for first-line treatment for somebody with a DVT. If there is a high risk of fall and they can't be on anticoagulation, that is in theory an indication, albeit a soft one, but you have to remember that it's not going to prevent the DVT from propagating. It's not going to prevent more developing DVTs, but it will just prevent pulmonary embolus. So what I would tell them is if you really can't anticoagulate them because the patient's falling with Parkinson's, then an IVC filter is not unreasonable, but it's not going to help the existing DVT. Okay, so again, this was a whole other talk, and I had a whole bunch of different filters and efficacies, and the answer is no, it's not 100% efficacy, and there's many reasons for that. If you really want to see, I can actually, no, I can't, because this is not my computer. There actually is a lot of reasons why the efficacy is not 100%. There's all kinds of different filter designs. There's all kinds of different reasons, from improper placement. The efficacy is not 100%, but the efficacy is pretty high in a well-placed IVC filter, which is not as simple as it sounds. Everybody thinks it's an easy thing to place an IVC filter. You know how it's supposed to look. You know where it's supposed to go. But there's a lot of pitfalls that you can miss when placing an IVC filter. And depending on the filter design, some are better at trapping clot than others. So it's never 100%, but what you want to do is prevent the large PE. You're not worried about the little ones that can go through the strands of the filter. You know, if you look at a filter, they're it's not like a coffee filter. It's not like going to prevent everything from going through. It's going to let things through it. But more importantly, there are a lot of anomalies that people miss when putting these. There's people with duplicated IVCs, the people with retrocaval IVCs, and those patients are going to get I've seen, if I can connect my computer, I can show you, cases where you have a filter and an IVC that looks perfectly placed. Well, but the patient had a DVT on the left, and the patient had a left-sided IVC, so the patient was completely unprotected. So that patient still got a PE. And you can say, well, that's a filter failure. Well, not really. It's an operator error. Is what it is. And that happens more commonly than you think. I have cases from here that you see on CT scan, you see filters in a perfectly placed infrarenal, and you see, oh, but you know what? The clot's on the other side, and there's a second inferior vena cava sitting right there. And that's actually not that uncommon, believe it or not. Filters are easy to place, easy to misplace, easy to not do properly. So the answer is you're right. No, it's not going to 100% prevent it. If done properly, and if the patient doesn't have an anomaly or if the anomalies are considered, it prevents the large PEs that are going to be fatal. I don't know if that answers it, maybe more than you wanted to hear. But I do actually have a whole other talk on that. Yes? Well, I would definitely put that on the criteria of the untreated things. So if they're not untreated, whether it's a mechanical or hemolytic reason, then I think those patients deserve to be on anticoagulation, as long as that underlying cause is there, whether it's mechanical or not. In terms of diagnosing them and figuring out what those I would defer to the hematologist. Maybe they'll have a talk on that. But I would consider that as an ongoing problem that needs ongoing treatment. Anything else?